Coming up in this podcast, the Trump COVID test, Mike McGowan's border battle, WA secessionists, state budget, property projects and special features on gold and tech infrastructure.
Welcome to Mark My Words, the weekly podcast from Business News with Mark Pownall and Mark Beyer discussing the important business news and data stories from Western Australia.
Welcome to Mark My Words, and with the two Marks both away this Friday, I'm Matt McKenzie and I'm joined by Jordan Murray.
Afternoon.
And Katie McDonald.
Hello.
Now the big news of today, massive news of today, Donald Trump testing positive to COVID-19. Wow, what a shock. Jordan, can you give us a quick update on what's happened?
So most people will be aware that he debated former Vice President Joe Biden earlier in the week. And on Wednesday, he visited a rally in Minnesota where his campaign aide, Hope Hicks, was thought to have contracted COVID-19. So when that was confirmed earlier on Friday, he was put into quarantine, and within hours after a rapid test, it was revealed that he and the First Lady have both contracted COVID-19. So as I understand it right now, they are both asymptomatic and they are quarantining. But obviously, Donald is in a high-risk category. He is 74 years old and he is known to be overweight. So this is obviously alarming news for the US, mm-hmm. and I imagine alarming news for markets as well.
So he tweeted, tonight, FLOTUS, that's the First Lady, and I tested positive for COVID-19. We'll begin our quarantine and recovery process immediately. We'll get through this, capitalised, together. Worth noting, Boris Johnson, UK Prime Minister, also suffered from this a bit earlier, and Bolsonaro over in Brazil. You said something to me before, which I found very interesting about Bolsonaro. Can you just give us the rundown on that?
So he contracted the virus in July. And had it for 2 weeks, and it was a very mild case. He managed to recover, I believe, relatively quickly. Approval rating shot up after that, and it's interesting to see that, but obviously given that he's in likely a better physical condition than the US president, you see a similar sort of pattern with Boris Johnson in the UK. Obviously, he went to hospital very briefly with the virus, came out, has lost quite a bit of weight since then, and briefly his approval rating shot up afterwards. They've come back down to earth now. But it'll be interesting to see whether that happens and whether there's public sympathy for the president after he contracted the virus.
Very interesting. Well, we'll be keeping a close eye on it, and you can, if we've learned anything about elections in America, who can predict them? Not us. Now, moving to Western Australian matters, there's been a lot of debate this week about the state's borders, and there's debate about it every week. Mark McGowan had some things to say, got him in a little bit of trouble. Jordan, what's happened?
Yeah, so as a bit of background, I think it's widely established now that WA has the hardest and harshest border restrictions in the nation. WA is the only state that hasn't committed to removing the restrictions before Christmas, and Premier has refused to sign on to this hotspot model that's favoured by the federal government and most other states. So now restrictions apply evenly to all states. Earlier in the week, they removed the stringent restrictions that were placed on arrivals from Victoria. They now can undergo 2 weeks of quarantine in a home or hotel. And we learned earlier this week as well, per guidance from the state's chief medical officer, Dr. Andrew Robertson, that Australia would need to go exactly 4 weeks, that's 28 days, without a single instance of community transmission of COVID-19 before WA is to relax its border. Now, Lisa Harvey earlier in the week criticised this stance, and she stated, as is well known by many, she stated for the borders to be closed, then for them to be reopened selectively, then closed selectively, and now reopened to all but Victoria. On Wednesday, she reiterated concerns about certainty for business, while announcing another tranche of funding under her local jobs guarantee. Now, industry bodies have begun to revolt against these border restrictions. Now, on Thursday, Premier McGowan was responding to some criticisms from other states about the speed with which we are reopening our borders, and had, generally speaking, he claimed that other states were being disingenuous in asking us to reopen our borders. He said that all they wanted was high-income earners from WA to go into their states and spend money. Now, industry bodies were not happy with this. Chamber of Commerce and Investment WA Chief Executive Chris Rodwell said that the restrictions now amounted to, and I'm quoting here, protectionism. And we're seeing a lot of similar criticisms from the likes of Tourism Council WA Chief Exec Evan Hall and Australian Hotels Association, WA Chief Exec Bradley Woods. They've similarly expressed frustration with this situation. Now, the argument they're making is that this isn't good for the economy, but there's some those top-line economic indicators. So you look at employment. Unemployment is now on par with the national average. And obviously the state government has announced a budget surplus this year, and we'll get to that in a minute. But Matt, it seems as if the borders remain closed and it's been a disaster for the economy, as these industry bodies are saying, it seems, I don't know, is this such an issue for the economy? I'm curious to hear what your thoughts are.
Yeah, good question, Jordan. I do want to say something on this, actually, because I think the criticism of Mark McGowan yesterday was a little bit disingenuous. And I really don't like it when politicians are criticised in a way which is only very, almost like you might call it a straw man, only it's a very small segment. So people were saying, oh, well, Mark McGowan is saying it's about the economy or whatever, and it's about, you know, economic protectionism, or it should be about health. Well, we know it's about health. The government has been in the Supreme Court. We know from the Supreme Court ruling that that keeping the borders closed is very important for health. We know that keeping out a second wave of the virus is very important to protect jobs and protect the economy. We saw what happened in Victoria, very bad. So there's all of that background and all of that context. And as you said, Mark McGowan was asked, well, if other states want you to open your borders, you know, what do you say to them? And his response was basically, there's no benefit for us. All we'll do is lose jobs. You know, the other states want us to open the border so they can take our money. And it's like, if that was his whole point, then I can understand people criticizing him. But it's not, right? It's in the broader context of there's the health impact, there's the protecting the economy from a second wave, and he's just responding to a single question. So to take out that little snippet of what he said and highlight that as if that was his whole argument, I think is a little bit disingenuous. Now, more broadly, we should absolutely be concerned about economic protectionism. And, you know, I've criticised the federal government and the state government in this podcast for these things before. In terms of the borders, you make a good point. I mean, here in WA, the big thing is protecting our mining industry. And BHP said earlier this week, keep the borders closed, please, so we can keep our mines open. And that's so important for WA. In terms of the tourism, it does impact some businesses, having the borders shut, for sure. But broadly for the economy, the most important thing is we need to keep our resources, our industry open. When we speak to small businesses here at Business News, we hear people say they like the borders being closed because it gives people confidence to spend. Any thoughts, Jordan?
Well, what I find interesting around this particular question is there's this perception that we're heading towards economic ruin if we're not already in economic ruin. And obviously we've had that discussion there and we've noted that generally speaking, the economy is performing okay at the minute.
It's recovering.
It's recovering, and it's getting there. And part of what I'm finding difficult to understand is it doesn't appear as if the public is behind this idea that we must reopen the borders as quickly as possible. Now, obviously, News Poll has regularly found Mr. McGowan's approval ratings are scraping somewhere of 90%. We obviously expect that to drop ahead of the state election, but that's still monumental numbers and would indicate broad public approval for his policies. Now, individual polling of the upcoming election indicates that the public is behind the state government pretty firmly. Now, former Labor staffer John Utting, I believe his name is, has been conducting some research that's been published in some of the state broadsheets. And there was some poll in July, in fact, that indicated that Labor could win 2/3 of the two-party preferred vote in the upcoming state election, which would be monumental. And in fact, there was some new polling today from John Utting again, and it even indicated that Lisa Harvey's seat in Scarborough, which is famously a very safe seat for the Liberal Party, would not be exempt from a coming red wave. So she would lose that seat in that scenario. So it's interesting to look at this situation. If we are heading towards, as I say, some sort of economic disaster, it seems as if the public either doesn't worry or doesn't see it.
Katie, what do you hear in the property industry?
Well, from a property perspective, keeping the borders closed, well, that takes out one of the key factors you need for property growth, which is population growth.
Yeah, okay.
However, we're finding that even if the borders are closed, there's still been quite a lot of growth in the market, and that's due to a lot of things, the housing stimulus packages pulling forward demand, which has been really great for the home building sector, in some ways bad because it's pulling forward demand and there's putting pressure on labour and that sort of thing. But also there's a backdrop of a 12-year shortage in rental stock. So we're actually seeing some of the house prices start to recover. So even though we don't have that population growth coming in, the market isn't actually doing as bad as you'd think.
Okay. Just on this general topic about how West Australians think and feel, this actually links in very quickly to one of the opinion pieces that was recently written for us, Jonathan Huston. What did he say?
So Jonathan Huston, he we may remember him as executive chairman of Croissant Express.
Delicious.
Yum.
Big fan of Croissant Express.
Love pastries.
So he's written this piece, and it concerns the idea that WA could secede. Now, obviously, WA secession is has a long tradition. This is merely the latest battleground. I believe GST was probably the last one. And, I mean, WA has always had this contentious relationship with the Federation, owing to the fact that we have a lot of wealth and we're obviously distant from the East Coast. Famously, Lang Hancock tried to get us out of it, and it was, in fact, to avoid protectionism, which... ironic, given what we've heard in recent days. And famously, in 1933, we voted 2-1 to leave the Federation. That was until the Crown famously told us to get stuffed. So Jonathan's piece is rather interesting, but he breaks down the finances of how we could, in fact, secede and become our own nation. And it's rather compelling the way he breaks it down. I mean, I've got some questions around it myself. He obviously has the numbers on his side, but I do question some of the calculations, particularly around defence. I don't know if he's factored in the idea that we may have to defend our eastern border, even if we would maintain peaceful relations with the rest of Australia. And it does seem as if the budget surplus that we would record as a result would be mostly spent on tax cuts. So, I mean, I have my own questions around it, but it's a very compelling read. I don't know if you have any particular views on secession.
Oh, well... on secession, not particularly. I like being part of Australia personally, but I think what he said, you know, from an economic perspective, it is worth highlighting that, and we write about this every so often here, it wasn't just the GST distribution, it's company tax, there's billions, and income tax in particular between them, and all the other taxes we pay to the Commonwealth government. It's actually, you know, most years during the boom time and then even after the boom, $20 billion a year almost being redistributed to other states. So I can understand people's frustrations on that. And on that topic... on the topic of many billions of dollars, the state budget. Jordan, what's the update there?
Yes, so the Treasurer announced over the weekend that we'd in fact record a $1.7 billion surplus, which I guess is a surprise to many, especially given that the federal government is set to record the largest deficit since World War II, in fact, which is again to be expected after the amount of spending that we announced. So WA is likely to be the only state to announce a budget surplus this year. And although it's under the mid-year projection of $2.6 billion, I think that's to be expected. Record iron ore prices appear to have kept royalties flowing into WA, so good news for us. But nevertheless, recurrent spending did increase over the last year, so it evens out, you know, here or there. So Ben Wyatt said, look, we're going to focus on supporting the economy rather than reducing the debt burden. And that's a change from previous years. In previous years, they've been heavily critical of Colin Barnett. They've said that he racked up quite a bit of debt. I know there's been a bit of dispute around that. And when we look at where the money will be spent, you know, it's a bit muddy at the moment. So Ben Wyatt, again, he said that the money will be put towards the asset investment program. In fact, the quote was that every cent would be put towards the asset investment program.
Okay.
And that the budget on Thursday will feature more stimulus spending. And again, this comes after the state government had spent the past 3 months touting its $6 billion recovery plan. And again, worth mentioning that about half of that had already been announced prior to this sort of big headline $6 billion number.
Okay.
Predictably, opposition, not happy with it, unimpressed with it. Dean Nalder came out on Saturday, said most of the support was coming from the federal government through its subsidy programs, and accused the state government of deferring dividend payments in an effort to shrink the surplus. Now, Water Corporation, I believe, deferred about $650 million of dividends.
Yeah.
That's just one example. But Mr. Nalder went pretty far with his criticisms. He called the figures as presented, quote, disingenuous. And he said that the state government's recovery plan was nothing but smoke and mirrors. Now, Matt, I'm curious to hear your opinions on this because I feel the debate around surpluses and deficits, it can be oversimplified. So I'm curious to hear whether you think we should be concerned about the fact that we have this close to $2 billion surplus.
Yeah, okay, there's some interesting points in there. That $640 million Water Corp dividend thing, we reported that in Business News. You know, I can understand what the board has done there. They delayed paying the dividend last financial year because of the, you know, COVID and who knew what was going to happen. But it does mean that a lot of money that would have been in the state budget last financial year will be in the budget this financial year. And what they do that with remains to be seen. We'll find out next week on the Thursday. One of the interesting things about the state budget is it's calculated differently from the federal budgets. The federal budget surplus or deficit is a cash surplus or deficit. The state budget is an operating balance, so it actually excludes a lot of capital investment items. So there's a little bit of nuance around that. I haven't actually been through the latest report to find out, you know, where Ben Wyatt's putting all that money. If it is going into infrastructure, we'll be able to see for the upcoming budget very soon. But it's possible. It's possible that money's going into infrastructure investment. As a broader point, though, you know, you made the point a lot of people are criticising the state government for not spending more money, not having a bigger deficit. My criticism, if anything, is this is a time where we need to start reforming our economy. It's not just about spending money on every idea anybody's ever had. We need to start making our economy competitive again. We need to start getting rid of these bad state taxes, cutting taxes. Katie, I'm sure you've got strong views on stamp duty, you know, as just one example. We need to start making our economy competitive and thinking about the power sector. How do we bring down energy prices in the long term? These are things that are not easy and they're not necessarily politically popular, but they need to be done for the long-term future of the state.
But also diversity as well. And with ECU announcing coming into the city, hopefully that will attract some more international students in the future as well. Terms of diversifying our economy.
It's interesting you bring up power and energy because obviously under Mike Nahan, the opposition had proposed to sell off Western Power. Under Lisa Harvey, they've since walked back that policy. Do you think support for those particular types of policies may give the opposition some credibility in the upcoming election and may give them some point of difference against the state government?
Yeah, good question. Very good question. My strong view is, that the opposition, the position that they're in right now, they'd probably benefit from doing something a little bit radical and a little bit different. And whether it be maybe one thing or two things, you don't want to confuse people. Maybe it's not Western Power, but I think they need to find that one big point of difference and focus on it every day until the election. And it could be stamp duty. It could be about making, improving housing affordability in a way that doesn't hurt existing homeowners. That could be very popular. Western Power is, we saw what happened in the last election on that. They didn't really campaign on the Western Power thing very hard, but they certainly had a campaign against them that was very difficult. But, you know, if you believe the Utting polling research, then, it can't get any worse. So doing something brave might be the wise thing to do.
Absolutely.
I want to ask on a very different note about property, Katie, your area of expertise. In particular, there was some recent data from the Planning Commission, was it?
The Department of Planning, Land and Heritage, yes. They put out their annual report. And if there's anyone out there that's interested in some light reading over the weekend, it is actually quite an interesting report when you dig into the data. Giving an overview of the last year, they said that they received 285 development applications valued at more than $5.4 billion during the financial year. Which is, that's quite substantial. Great for the economy. Everybody's talking about how property and construction is one way to stimulate that economic activity and support jobs, etc. And they're hoping to stimulate that further with a lot of planning reform. You mentioned stamp duty before. But one of the major ones that has come about in recent months is this streamlining of development approvals. So that was... a major change to the Planning Act, and that's a new development assessment pathway over the next 18 months for specific projects deemed significant. So they're those projects that are valued at $20 million or more in the Perth metro area and $5 million or more in the regional area. And that's, that's a pretty good threshold for most projects out there. In addition to that act over the last year, they also made 112 local planning scheme amendments, which I think is quite significant. There's been a lot of noise recently around Nedlands. I mean, they changed their planning scheme recently. And there's been like a tsunami of development applications is what the mayor describes that there. And that's, around density and activity centres. And that's happening all around kind of the Perth City fringe at the moment.
So to get an idea just on this, so these are 112 scheme amendments, and would each of these amendments be one in each sort of area or which council?
Across a lot of different councils. So the Department of Planning, Land and Heritage, one of the organisations that falls under that is the Western Australian Planning Commission, among others. There's also a few Aboriginal land departments that come under that as well. So it's been a busy year. But we really need that. And I think it was actually pretty great timing, considering everything that's happened with COVID, to change some of these planning schemes. Now, there'll be some growing pains, pardon the pun there, because it is higher density than what a lot of people are used to. But it comes at a time where we are looking to stimulate the economy, and construction can do that. And so developers have certainly taken notice, and places like Nedlands, really close to the city, somewhat great transport networks, since there's a little bit more infrastructure to go in there. And it's a great place to live. It's near a university, close to the city, all that sort of thing. So a lot of developers have taken notice of that, and they're really trying to ramp up apartments in there, and hopefully in a responsible, appropriate way. Also in the report, touching on kind of Aboriginal land and heritage sites.
And this is a topic of great interest at the moment.
Yes. Given everything that's happened, I was quite interested digging further into the report. There were 444 site assessments conducted for protection under the Aboriginal Heritage Act 1972. So that's also quite interesting. If you're interested in that, listeners, really great reading over the weekend.
Or you could read Katie's story about it.
Or you could read my story about it. That's it.
Speaking of your stories, you would like the metaphorical news hound on something that happened in Murdoch, which you were chasing.
Yes.
And you got it.
Yes.
Tell us what happened.
Yes, I heard whispers a few weeks ago of Adrian Finney's Hesperia group acquiring more land around the Murdoch Health and Knowledge Precinct. So been trying to follow that up the last few weeks. And pretty much they are the master developer for the Murdoch Health and Knowledge Precinct, which is a significant commercial project in WA at the moment. And they acquired lot 118, so they're going to put some apartments there.
Okay.
About 120 of them, 10-storey building. And previously those apartments were included in 1A of the project, stage 1A. But they actually found that there was more appetite for health and medical product than they initially thought. So to accommodate that demand, they've changed the composition of the project slightly and then put the apartments on another section.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
So that's an interesting point, actually, about the demand for health.
Mm. Especially in these times.
Yeah. Okay. So they're building this precinct down there, and obviously there must be a lot of potential businesses that want to use the space.
Yeah, there's a lot going down there. So the Murdoch Health and Knowledge Precinct is a development WA-led project, and it's considered to be the catalyst for the delivery of a broader Murdoch Activity Centre. So that's expected to support about 35,000 jobs, 22,000 residents, and facilities for up to 44,000 students when it's completed. So it's pretty big.
Okay. And staying on this theme of property, there's a lot of new data out, I understand, about, what is it, building approvals?
Yep, building approvals and house prices beginning of a new month means some new data. So CoreLogic put out their monthly data and found that houses in Perth are increasing in value by 0.2%. That might not seem like a lot, but it's pretty great for a market that has been struggling over recent years. And in recent months, there's been kind of zero change or minimal fall, which suggests that we're finally finding house prices steadying. Now, that is a very blanket look at the market, obviously. There's different pockets of Perth that experience different price movements. But overall, that's what they're finding, that house prices are remaining steady. And good news for everybody else out there is that housing in Perth has also continued to be viewed as the most affordable in the national market.
Most affordable.
Mm-hmm. The city recorded a median value of $445,717 in the past year, more than $100,000 cheaper than the median value of housing across Australia.
Wow. Mm. So we're cheap housing here.
Supposedly, yes, according to their data. Okay. On top of that, building approvals, demand for new houses remained strong, and that's no surprise given the recent housing stimulus packages that were announced by both federal and state government. So for houses, there was a 34.9% jump in building approvals in WA across August.
Well, there you go. Big jump.
Yes. Time will tell to see whether how that's going to steady out, given we've pulled forward quite a lot of housing demand, whether that will drop off or whether we'll actually see more, it remaining steady.
Interesting.
But all industry groups are pushing for time extensions to kind of level that demand out in terms of the conditions around stimulus packages and delivery timeframes.
Thank you, Katie. Now, in this upcoming magazine, which comes out on Monday, Jordan, there's two features. You did one of them about technology infrastructure. Mm-hmm. What did you learn?
So it's one of those topics that is simultaneously dry and political, I find. So NBN has been the big story of the last decade when I had a look into it. And those of us who remember, as far back as 2007, Labor came to government and there was this multi-billion dollar plan to connect every single premise or 9 out of 10 premises in Australia to fibre to the premise connection. So this was the connection where you'd get the cable running directly into your house and you would get super fast internet and it would allow you to download up to 1 gigabyte per second. Now, in 2007, there wasn't much demand for this technology and the opposition at the time was quite critical of this, and I think understandably so. And that played out over the course of 6 years, and those of us who remember the 2010 election, famously two regional independents managed to secure NBN access to rural locations in New South Wales. Now, at the time, that was criticised because there was not this perception that there was that demand for internet in those areas. It was seen as wasteful. And in 2013, when the Liberals came to power, they paused that rollout and they went back to the drawing board and they said, hey, we can do this cheaper and we can do this faster. And they essentially used a mixed-use model of internet. So this was a mix of different connections, and fibre to the premise was mostly stopped at that point because there wasn't this perceived demand that we needed 1 gigabyte per second downloads. So fast forward to now, and the network is in fact completed. But internet download speeds in Australia still lag global averages, at least through the fixed connection. And there's a lot of discussion about how we're going to meet now 1 gigabyte per second demand, given that that is now on the horizon. So you would have seen, I think, last fortnight, Communications Minister Paul Fletcher came out and he said that there was going to be $4.5 billion spent towards upgrading homes and getting them that fixed fibre to the premise model. But there's still a lot of criticism around the timing of that and whether that should have been done earlier. Now, one of the things I did as part of this was I looked at some of the alternatives to NBN. In Perth, we've got Pentanet. People may be aware of them. They sponsor the Wildcats. They use a very interesting technology, which is fixed wireless. So that's through satellite dishes, in fact. And they cover 80% of Perth with their internet connection. And they can offer that gigabyte per second download right now, in fact. So it's an interesting market looking forward, whether these people will be able to compete. Perth famously had iiNet, which grew through a series of acquisitions and had managed to compete with some of those established figures. They've now been rolled into TPG Telecom. I think that was about 5 years ago. But it's interesting looking at that market as demand grows for internet over the next decade and whether the NBN will be able to cope and adapt and whether it'll be as politicised as it was over the previous decade. Now, Matt, I don't know how closely you followed that NBN debate, but I'd love to hear your input on that one.
Yeah, I just love to see Pentanet, private business that's going out there doing their thing. Mm-hmm. West Aussies, we're so entrepreneurial in this state, and I love to see it. And I think it's an example of, kind of, Pentanet is almost an example of what the whole criticism was of the NBN in the first place, which is that, you know, innovative, entrepreneurial people can come up with their own ideas and their own solutions, and they can do it in a way that works for them. And I don't need a 1 gigabyte per second connection, but people who do, you know, they're gonna be happy to pay a bit more for it. They're gonna want to do it in a way that, you know, is sort of flexible. So Pentanet, fantastic. And the other thing I like about it, and I don't want to spoil this for readers, but your little analysis of the story of Pentanet, very interesting. So keep an eye out for that in the next edition. The other feature, Jordan, was about gold.
Mm. So Jessica Massioni wrote this. She's been writing about resources for a little over a year now for us. It's an interesting piece because obviously gold has performed relatively well in the past few months, as is to be expected. Investors have rushed into that as most other sectors have suffered. And she's done a very interesting broad overview of the sector. There's a lot of corporate finance activity happening in there and a lot of IPOs, in fact, as well. And I don't know, Matt, if you've been following gold too closely over the last 5 years, but how would you compare how it's currently performing to, say, the last time that gold really shot through the roof, which I imagine would have been around GFC, no?
Well, I wasn't a journalist in the GFC, I will say, but, you know, the price was above US $2,000 an ounce by early August. Mm. And I think if you'd said, you know, some years ago that the gold price would get to that level, people would have been maybe in disbelief. But it has gone up very significantly, and that's meant It's been good for WA because we get a lot of export revenue out of it. Mm. And Jess actually points out in this story, she says, directly WA's gold sector employs about 26,000 people, while iron ore employs 48,000. So even though gold exports aren't about half of iron ore exports, they're a bit less. Mm. They're a bit less than that. They are employing almost half the amount of people directly as iron ore. So it shows it's a very significant part of the state's economy. So it's a very interesting read there from Jess, and you'll be able to check it out in our latest edition. And there is a map that we've put together of some of the gold producers around Western Australia. You'll get that in your edition on October 5th. It'll be an onset, and please put it up on your wall. Enjoy it. Katie, Jordan, thank you for being here today.
Thank you.
Thanks, Matt.
And friends, we'd love for you to continue to listen to this podcast. Next week, the Marks will return. And then in the weeks ahead, please check out our website and subscribe.
Thanks for listening to Mark My Words with Mark Pownall and Mark Beyer from Business News. For more information, please go to businessnews.com.au/podcasts. And to receive these regularly, search for Business News WA in iTunes or SoundCloud.